Welcome to episode 25 of the Crystal Habit Podcast. This episode is actually be broken down into two segments. The first one will continue our breaking into the game industry feature. So this time we are going to take a look at concept, character, and environment art with three individuals from the studio. I will say right off the bat, these gentlemen are hilarious, and a large majority of the podcast is the four of us breaking down into laughing fits. But regardless of the laughing fits, they're advice is actually fantastic, and I think it offers great insight into what to expect if you're getting into gaming in one of these more artistic vocations. After that, we're going to take some time out to talk to Scott Amos, who is an EP here at Crystal Dynamics, and we're going to speak to Tomb Raider Definitive Edition and give you a little bit of a breakdown on what to expect from that release, which is coming out in late January. Enjoy the show. All right, welcome back, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Crystal Habit Podcast, episode 25. I can already tell you guys that this episode is going to be a lot of fun because the guys in front of me have a hard time keeping a straight face. This week, we're going to focus on some industry opportunities for those who are looking to use their artistic skills specifically. There's quite a few opportunities, it turns out. We'll be taking a look at concept, character, and environment art today. And then next episode, we're going to tackle animation, VFX, and UI. So Let's put a name to these voices you guys hear giggling in the background. It's my fault for picking the room that has the glass walls, so everyone, you guys are just seeing everybody walk by. Yeah. First, we have concept director Brennock Adams. You've been on the podcast before.
I've been on a couple, yeah.
Yeah, so you're like a pro at this. All right.
Total pro.
And then we have lead character artist Dan Rorty.
Yeah, how's it going?
Hello. And then lead environment artist Josh Babst.
How's it going, guys?
It's going well.
Good to see you,
Josh. If
they
could answer you,
feeling
they
strong.
Would say yeah. They're excited.
Should I not pose questions to the podcast group?
I think it's more immersive. They can just...
It's not going to work out at all.
I think they appreciate you taking the time to ask.
Yeah, all right.
All right.
I meant the question.
Okay. So let's start off first and foremost by defining exactly what each of your jobs entail and kind of how you interact with each other in a studio setting. So let's start with Bren.
Yeah.
Concept director, yeah. As a concept artist, what is your role and responsibility in making a game?
Well, we're responsible for the blueprint level of stuff. So having to work with these two jokers is quite difficult. It's we're being in the same
Let's
room
be
with
honest,
them.
Folks. Let's be honest.
Let's not beat around the bush. You guys suck.
It's just to kind of put it simply, it is more of the kind of blueprint level. So we're able to provide the characters, environments, and props and storyboards and so forth that go out to Dan to be able to create characters or Josh to be able to create environment art. And it's a fun job.
So are you, as a concept director or a concept artist, are you constantly working? Is your workload like front heavy at the beginning of the project, and then how does that kind of transition as you get into development?
We don't have a huge group of concept artists, so in general we start out by having there's five of us right now that are on this current project, mm-hmm. and we start off by doing just about everything that you could possibly think of: storyboards, again, characters, environments. As it gets towards production, it's a little more of the kind of filling holes here and there and trying to make sure that everybody's fed info so that when we get to the point where we have to paint over something and someone's not clear about something, we're able to give them the quick sketch or whatnot that's going to keep moving forward. At that point, we usually have established what the general look is and what mm-hmm. the kind of flavor of the whole deal is. So it's really more about just providing as much info and support as we can to each team.
Okay. So, Dan, as a lead character artist, are you considered still then a concept artist? Are you working primarily on concepts, or do you do actual implementation into the game?
So, I'll actually, like, working with Bren or one of Bren's guys, he'll deliver, like, a concept or work-in-progress concept, and then I'll kind of conceptualize it in 3D based off what he's done or what one of the other concept guys done. And it's pretty cool. There's a lot of back and forth. Sometimes there's more kind of strict concepts you have to follow kind of to the T, but usually it's more loose where, you know, Bren or one of the guys will kind of leave a little bit to the artist's interpretation, which is pretty cool. So taking what he does in 2D and then bring it and making it in 3D.
Do you guys ever get into like little ownership disputes where you're like, no, it has to be this way. It has to be this way.
No. I think part of the process is going from 2D to 3D is it's a weird gap to kind of cross because it's never going to look quite how you want to within in 3D. So Dan consistently will take it to the next step and make something that we put down in you know 2D make quite a bit better, I think.
So seen as an evolution rather than just a direct translation.
Absolutely. And I think that's the point is that we need someone like Dan to be able to bridge that gap.
Right. And then how about you, Josh? As a lead environment artist, are you then working with the concepts and implementing them into these actual 3D worlds?
Yeah. Typically, when we get started on a process, the art director and concept director will get together to sort of flesh out what the tone and composition for the spaces that we're going to be looking to build, like what's the space going to feel like, and there's a giant beard looking through a glass. I don't even know if that man has a face. I'm pretty sure it's just a beard.
It's not even November anymore.
we'll basically flesh out the backdrop, the world that the player interacts with, that they explore throughout the game.
Okay, so now that we understand what you guys do here, let's take a step back and kind of understand how you got to this point. So we'll start with you again, Bren. Uh-huh. What sort of education or training did you receive to get to this point?
I went to the glorious University of San Jose State University. And I went through the animation illustration program there with a bunch of terrific professors, and we had a lot of exposure to games and film and so forth that kind of crafted what I want to do now. And they were pretty much instrumental in showing and kind of directing me into, hey, what do you want to do? Games, film, and so forth. And I was like, games is awesome.
Yeah.
And it just felt like the right avenue. And from there, working ridiculous hours, not, sleeping, which is what we all do here.
Yeah.
Is
pretty universal.
And ended up going to a company out of college up north in Novato, and then ended up here in 2008 working on Underworld.
Very cool. How about for you, Dan?
So, a Canadian boy.
Nope.
So, didn't grow up in Toronto. So, I went to a college place at the time. It was called Center for Digital Imaging and Sound. It's actually been changed now to the Art Institute. Kind of the same thing, spent, any waking moment I'd have basically living at the school. And my first gig was I was still in college. And I guess one of the owners of the college was friends with a guy from MTV, just happened to be in the school at the time. Saw the demo reel I was working on and offered me kind of a contract there on the spot. So I finished off my demo reel, did a little small film for MTV, and then basically same kind of thing, got into games and moved my way up here to the States, and now I'm at Crystal.
Very cool. And you, Josh?
So I went to school in Brooklyn, New York at Pratt Institute. I got a BFA in Computer Graphics Interactive Media. And after I graduated, I did a couple freelance projects in and around the greater New York area. And I don't mean to sound like a rock star, but...
Relax.
I worked in some commercial production houses, like modeling previs for like Pillsbury Doughboy and Febreze commercials. It's a pretty big deal. I know. I was walking around like king of the world.
Like you own the spot.
Yeah. No surprise where I am now.
Yeah, it's clear as day.
And then there was only one AAA game studio in New York at the time, Chaos Studios THQ. And I actually got my foot in the door through QA there and then quickly worked my way out and got promoted to art producer. And then I pretty much worked there till the studio closed in, I think it was 2010. And then I joined the staff here at Crystal Dynamics.
Great. So it's interesting because one of the... I think this is becoming less of a conversation because I think people are realizing how technical the field is, even if you're doing art. But there was for a long time a conversation about, do I need to go to school? Do I need to have a formal education to work in games? And a lot of the times when it came to more of the artistic vocations within gaming, people would say, well, as long as you're just super talented, it's not as much of a priority. Where do you guys kind of fall on that? Do you think is it a mixture of being self-taught and trained and also education, or how do you?
Yeah, you can go first.
Self-taught education.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't talent will definitely only get you so far. All of us here have worked our asses off for hours and hours, and it's all about mileage, and it's all about making sure that you're dedicating yourself to that craft. And I'd believe that with just about anything, but
yeah.
I think that there is a technical side to what we do. That's there are a lot of roadblocks, and there are a lot of things that we can't do that say something, you know, film might be able to. We're starting to kind of, those are starting to go away slowly, but that's still, we still work our asses off constantly to make sure that we're, this industry changes so fast and we have to be able to keep up with it.
Yeah.
So it's really, I would say the technical understanding that people think they have to have coming in, you will learn here and you will totally get here. It's just that you have to work extremely hard to be able to keep up with it.
I think that's important too. Hard work, talent, and training. It seems like a good balance.
Yeah, there. I mean, like Brent said, I think we've always been like driven, and in school though, school will teach you kind of some things. I don't know if you necessarily be able to pick up all on your own, like some of the kind of foundational art history, and you know, going to school, we were learning a lot about like film and even like 2D animation stuff, which is pretty cool. I don't think I would have been able to teach myself that kind of stuff. And for me though, I think I've learned the most, you know, working in the industry, working with all these guys and stuff, but I wouldn't have been able to move to the States and get a green card and all that kind of stuff without education. So from that standpoint, for me, it's been like, been like super, super important. But the other part of that is I don't think anybody, you always have to keep learning. Like you're never going to stop. Like I know Bren does the same thing and Josh as well. That you go home and you basically obsess about it. You're always working on stuff all the time. So yeah, it's a constant learning thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the university sort of experience is a good framework for keeping you oriented and propelling you forward in terms of your education. But at the end of the day, you have to be very proactive. Since the industry is constantly changing and the technology is constantly changing, you really want to be testing out all the new technologies, you know, play around with like Unreal Development Kit, any like new ZBrush type of programs that are coming out, and not just relying on the framework of your curriculum, but also seeing what you can learn just by getting out there and networking with people
above
in the
beyond.
Area.
Absolutely.
It's good for like contacts and stuff too. Eh?
Yeah.
Like I know like, that's Canadian. we still like, it's such a small industry too. Like you go to school with some of the people you did back in the day, and you still talk to Mike Wazowski.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mike Wazowski.
There he is. Chris O'Campbell.
Yeah. That's right.
So. It's the smallest big, large industry.
It's crazy how small it is.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's jump into what's the day to day like working at Crystal in your position then, and who do you collaborate with most on a daily basis? Is it kind of, you guys, your general positions collaborate and work together a lot. Do you work with other vocations and specialties within the studio frequently? Whoever wants to start.
I don't really work with Josh all that much, which is disappointing. We always have such a good time.
Yeah.
I'll speak really quickly saying that you do work with a lot of different disciplines, like from the tech side and art side. Obviously, a lot of the art stuff with Bren or Brian, and then with the tech side, you know, John Robbins or Morten Mikkelsen with engineering and stuff. So you do collaborate with all the disciplines, which is pretty awesome, actually. I really like that.
Yeah. Okay. The studio here definitely has a smaller, more boutique feel, and sort of the pillar of our production is that everybody is collaborating together. It's very important that art and design, animation, characters, effects are all working hand-in-hand towards building as great of an experience as possible. And we don't try to approach our day-to-days in sort of siloed form. It's very organic.
Yeah, it is very free form. We kind of it really depends on what we're working on, but we will literally go to just about every discipline. I mean, if we have to get some rendering help, we'll go to some programming. If we have to get some character work and so forth, we just kind of bounce around. I think that's one of the beautiful things about where we are here is we're able to go do that. We're not there's no velvet rope where we have to stop and say, wait a minute, you can't talk to this.
Yeah.
We are able to talk to anybody at any time, which keeps things flowing.
Great. And how does that day-to-day sort of evolve as the project goes forward? So, I mean, I imagine you start out at first just kind of establish in general what the character looks like and how they will be implemented in the game. And how does that, as you get further in, what are you working on and refining?
Well,
and
it's funny when you talk to people, like the day-to-day, all the day-to-day is different depending on like what you're working on. But, you know, from a character standpoint, we'll all constantly work back and forth with Bren on like what what his vision or the feeling is for a character. But we'll basically start off with block meshes, building out of mind and stuff, getting some kind of basic proxies in, then John will rig it up, throw it in game. And then from there, we'll look at the silhouette and start building the high res using ZBrush. Or Mudbox. Start building the high res, get approval from there from Brennan, the art director, and then going into a texturing phase, starting to build the in-game. Mm-hmm. And then ideally, like, put all the nice shaders and textures and stuff, and that's when we'll have a finished project. But it's definitely a long and exciting process.
How is it pretty similar for you in terms of the process of fleshing out the world?
Yeah, so I think for our typical environment artists on the project, it's very similar to day-to-day that Dan has. You know, we try to keep a good portion of the team focused on content creation, so they're getting in there, building all of the narrative prompts that sort of help establish, like, the lore of our world. Mm-hmm. And then we also have environment artists, typically ones that are more senior, that are helping. Really, they're the world builders. They're generating the composition. They're helping tone the experience with the designers, and they're mm-hmm. they're building the broad picture. As a lead environment artist, I start early in the project, in the pipeline, going down to the details, producing content, helping establish sort of like what the quality bar will look like for the game. And then as the project ramps up and more staff come on, then I typically go into more of a managerial role in terms of managing the art direction for the environments and also making sure we have the right team.
Okay, great. If you guys don't mind, I like to ask this question for some of the more proactive people listening who maybe want to start learning tools and technology. Even we have a lot of people in high school that listen to this podcast. So do you guys have any specific tools or programs that you use regularly or you feel like could give people an edge if they wanted to start playing around in it?
Holy cow. Yeah. Well, there's the standards that are super important, you know, Maya mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. ZBrush is obviously a big one. But you're finding out that there's so many new tools that are coming out all the time. It's always, like you said, always really good to be super proactive and learn some more tools. Mari's a big texturing thing we're starting to look at too. Nold is a tool that Morin's developing here for baking out maps. There's Mudbox. I use Shaving a Haircut. Shaving a Haircut. It's kind of a newer. It's a newer tool they use to actually create splines for hair, but you can actually render hair and stuff. All these kind of like crazy cool. It's
really granular programs.
There's a ton, and I'm sure Josh uses a bunch. He can tell you about more of them too. But there's literally loads of them.
Yeah,
and you always have to be proactive, like keep learning them and stuff.
Yeah, and it's also about, I think, experimenting with all of them and finding what you're most comfortable with. Because, for example, Dan, I think, is a little more prone to using Mudbox just because of the interface and how it can kind of craft. And he will use ZBrush for specific stuff. But I think that for the most part, it's about poking at all these different things and figuring out what mm-hmm. works best for you. And I think that from a lower level of just trying to get into this stuff is figuring out what you like and what you don't like about your program that keeps your workflow good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that's something that you'll learn as you just get mileage to start cranking out stuff. But to try to figure out what you like more than other, you know, interfaces is totally crucial now, because you can get stuck with some crap that just doesn't work and find this beautiful new piece of tech and you're like, where's this metal?
The environment side, we use a lot of the same sort of technology, ZBrush, Mudbox, Photoshop, Maya. There's a lot of cool new procedural material makers that are sort of coming out that we're just starting to explore. Same with terrain generation. We're using a program called World Machine that's really exciting for this Tomb Raider production mm-hmm. for helping create really large, expansive vistas.
Mm-hmm.
And I would definitely suggest anybody who's sort of getting their start in the industry, one of the most important pieces of software to learn is some sort of development kit using Unreal or learning the CryEngine. Looking at their content in the game mm-hmm. environment, it teaches them so much about the pipeline.
Other than, you know, the talent, the hard work, the training that we established, what other skills should you develop to cohesively work with others as a studio setting? I think it's interesting because people just inherently see gamers as kind of like lone wolves or so on. But making games, you can't necessarily just like hold yourself up and be like a little hobbit. You have to work with other people and you have to collaborate. I like to ask people, like, what other skills, like interpersonal skills or so on, do you need to develop?
So
to work
I would just like to quickly say that it's okay to be a hobbit though.
Hobbits are kind of badass.
A lot of people don't wear shoes.
Mind.
So. I think some of the stuff, if we're speaking to kids that are coming out of school or mm-hmm. trying to get a job, I think actually marketing your own work, figuring out how to do that best, there are so many good artists out there right now. and you are going up against Dan, and you're going up against B, and you're going up against Josh, and that's a very difficult thing to do because you've been doing it longer than you, and that's just there's the business side of things too, and there's talking to people and understanding how to make something work within a group, and this is not about sitting at your desk and just cranking out stuff. This is about working with people and understanding what they're good at and how to use them just as well as they have to use you. Mm-hmm. And I think communication with people is paramount, mm-hmm. constant. I mean, I'll be at Dan's desk constantly, talking to Josh constantly. All you know, and this is something that I think people look at and they go, "I just have to do great art," and that's just not the truth. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a very very small part of it.
I would totally agree with all that. The other thing too, especially for students or kids coming out of school and stuff, I think one thing you got to learn to develop pretty quickly is like a thick skin, and mm-hmm. You can definitely have a lot of pride in the work you do and stuff, but in the end, if someone's giving you critiques or giving you feedback and stuff, never take it personally because it's mm-hmm. almost always for the better and stuff.
That's been a reoccurring one I've heard, is that you can't be married to your work. You have to be able to iterate and have a thick skin.
Yeah. Definitely. I think also adaptability is an important thing in our environment. There's a lot of innovation happening within our industry, and there's a lot of change mm-hmm. that I think as a developer you have to get used to sort of on a day-to-day basis, like things come up. So being able to adapt to sort of any scenario that kind of comes your way and being able to work well with others is paramount for sure, along with communication.
Great. So what do you think is the best part of being an artist working in games, and what is the most challenging aspect of it?
I think it's exactly what Josh just said, is that everything's everything is evolving way too fast. It's insane, and we're just trying to keep up with it. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the most exciting things, I mean, for me, I got into games because I like to draw stuff and put it down there and see it on like screen, like moving. You're like, oh my God, that's the thing that I thought in my head would do this, and now it's doing that, and that still blows my it's there's.
Relax.
There's me. I get pumped up about
it. We're a mature game, and we've had Carl Stewart on the podcast before. So we've definitely had swearing.
I was about to drop like 7 F-bombs.
You're yelling right now.
Lose your train of thought.
I'm just staring at Josh blankly now for what I was talking about. I got so pumped up about something. I just like it. Games are so much fun. That's it.
The changing environment and the changing landscape keeping up with that. That thing.
Yeah.
All right. So how about Dan and Josh? Do you have similar feelings?
I love, like, I'm a big film guy and stuff, but it's just seeing how much like tech is kind of evolving and being able to see something real time is really cool. And you're noticing right now that you're getting a lot of transitions from guys working on films coming to starting to work on games, and mm-hmm. the gap between both of them is dramatically, like, it's closing, where it's getting to a point now where it's going to be pretty hard to distinguish here pretty soon the difference between both of them. It's awesome. It's from the art side, you're able to start working on stuff that's closer to something you'd see on the big screen, and being able to marry it with new and cool evolving technology is just awesome.
It's very exciting to see some of the stuff that we've been seeing just really really recently. Some of the newest stuff that we're seeing internally, we have some stuff that's kind of like, whoa, what are we doing now? That's awesome.
That's what I think I'm most excited about is some of the stuff we've been doing here. Like with all, we got so many like smart, talented people here and stuff.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Except for Josh.
Too bad. Yeah.
Poor Josh. Let me
see your shirt. That's a hell of a shirt.
Yeah, you'd like me to take it off?
No, that's okay. That's
all
okay.
Right. Thank you. I think that.
Look at that V-neck.
Sorry. Right.
Hi. It's my V-neck.
Yeah, people in California don't appreciate the V-necks as much as the East Coast guys. Well, it's actually like, apparently. I actually have to wear an undershirt sometimes under my V-neck.
Just for context for people out there, Josh looks almost exactly like Conan O'Brien's son.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't even know.
I'm not even sure if he has children. But I could be. I've called him about it. I've tried to convince him that I was. But he saw the V-neck and knew immediately that I was not.
This is getting. Oh, look.
You guys are making an argument for me to start taking pictures in the podcast.
I've been talking for a while. I forgot the question.
The question was best technology. And most challenging part of being
environment
artist.
I think Dan kind of touched on it. Is it's the quality bar that is probably the most the fun thing to hit. I think this is such an art house sort of studio here where everybody's trying to push it as far as they can in each discipline, and being able to build the worlds that Lara Croft can explore is really an honor. It's a legacy game in our industry. And I think that the challenging part is getting that done on time, for sure.
Yeah. I think that's probably universally challenging across most game studios.
Yeah.
I have no idea what that noise was.
So being able to handle the duality of both, is this getting closer to my noise? For anybody who's not, we don't have video here, but right I don't have the soft little protector for my microphone. So it's lodged right between my eyeball and my right nostril. It's very hard to focus, guys.
We wanted to make sure that
we're going
to
retape
this. There weren't some puffing noises.
This will never hit the net.
I'm failing, guys. I'm sorry.
We should just take a picture of me after this and post it right on the podcast picture. Like, who is this idiot?
I'll replace the album art with your face. There we go. Okay. A couple more questions, because I know you guys are super, super busy. What is a potential advancement in each of your specialties? So concept artist to concept director and so on. Can you guys kind of step through the advancement and what people could look forward to if they stuck to one thing for a while?
As far as going from concept to concept director, you mean? Okay.
Yeah, in a career. If someone was specifically looking into concept, wanting to work with concept art, how could they advance themselves?
It's gonna be a very consistent message. Is that especially with concept art? It's about it really is about this vicious cycle of self-hatred, where you realize that you're not as good as the next guy out there that you just saw, and trying to get better.
Okay.
And so it's there's those skills that you have to constantly develop alongside the fact that now you have to work with people. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really about understanding, about working with people, and then eventually kind of managing people. And if you're working with different concept artists, how to train them and try to get them better. Mm-hmm. Recognize some of the things they're not potentially doing right for what games needs. I think the step from going from concept artist to concept artist director was simply be able to help younger concept artists get, you know, better. I think actually one of the more important things is that concept art for games is very different than concept art for something like film. Mm-hmm. Where I'm positive this is not about painting pretty pictures. Even though it's about painting pretty pictures, this is about designing something. And I think games is going to have a lot more roadblocks that I think a lot of younger artists are going to have to figure out. So concept art specifically for what we do here is maybe not exactly what people think.
Yeah.
It's not always about make me something beautiful. It's make something functional and then make it beautiful.
Form and function.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the recognition of like going from concept artists to driving concept artists is that's a kind of a big gap to kind of get. You just understand that you're here to help everybody else understand what the hell you're actually making.
And so in I'm not sure if this is applicable to any of these fields, but can you move then to like art director role where you're overseeing like an artistic vision for the project from any of these specific vocations?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You totally can.
Okay.
Josh probably can.
The skills are the skills are applicable though. Yeah. Once you move from more of the content to the
material
of a vision.
It's okay. So this is my take on this whole thing. Is that really it's about you have to kind of say to yourself, I'm going to be art director now, and there's just a little bit of a shift where now you're going to have to drive a vision a little bit differently. It's not necessarily about executing work constantly. No, it's just a different mindset. But you can absolutely choose to do that.
Okay. And how about for you too? Is it a similar sort of path if you move up the ladder in character and environment art?
Yeah, probably pretty similar. I think speaking of what Brent was saying, you have to know what you really want to do. Like I love sitting down. I love making badass characters. I really love doing all that kind of stuff. I don't necessarily know if I would I guess you can move on further, but I really enjoy kind of what I'm doing now, and I'm lucky enough that in a lead position at this studio, which hasn't been the same at some other studios I've worked at, that I'm able to do a ton.
He's laughing.
That I'm able to. We talked about it. To be able to do, I'm able to do a lot of hands-on work and be able to keep pushing all the art stuff. And when it comes to all the scheduling and all that kind of stuff, like we're lucky enough that we have some pretty awesome producers and stuff that kind of handle that. So, for me, I'm pretty content right now. I'm pretty happy.
I think for environment art, there's definitely several tiers. We have associate, mid, and senior, and principal. And I think if someone's looking to further their career path, there's sort of two tracks that can kind of present themselves. And one's very similar to what Dan's sort of speaking about. And specifically for the environment side, that's sort of in the principal artist role, where if they have several years of experience and they've shown us like incredible amounts of like quality that they can achieve on the project. We try to keep these sort of guys in a position where they can continue to make content. And then we also have the lead track, which is more oriented in the, you know, how are we going to get this all made? What's the pipeline going to look like? What are the feelings for all these spaces that we want to hit across the project? Big picture. Did you just you just peeled out a little gurgle there? You should probably put this closer to your eyeball, like I am.
We'll see if it was picked up on the podcast. Yeah. How
someone's
the
a little gassy. It's endearing.
All kinds of
it's nice.
This is actually still way more productive than I thought it was going to be.
The air pressure feels a little different in here.
Okay, sorry. Yeah. Pipeline.
And pipeline. Yeah. So print. We have sort of. You can focus more on sort of becoming an environment lead or working more towards the principal artist and environment team, and then that of course can evolve into art director, creative director, game director in sort of future. Depends on the individual, what their strengths are and what their ambitions sort of look like.
So the senior most artistic directors and so on projects can come from any specialty if they've shown their skills or so on.
Oh yeah,
okay. I think so. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Very cool. Next question.
Okay.
I looked at a couple of resources online and they actually broke down some things that you should try to diversify your portfolio with when presenting it to a project. Things that people maybe wouldn't have thought of, like certain character expressions or trying to make sure you're showcasing different types of work and your thought process and so on. So from a professional standpoint, what is important to highlight in your portfolio to show your
really
diverse skill set and so on?
That's actually a 7-part question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the first part would be, I think from my point of view, it would be to cater your portfolios towards what you're applying for, if that makes sense.
Yep.
So no matter what work you're doing, whether it's you enjoy doing more of the action, adventure, sci-fi, whatever you end up doing, wherever you send your portfolio, people are going to obviously look at your first page first. It's got to speak about, you know, that this actually comes back to marketing your own work. And it's catering your portfolios towards what you want to do. And I think Dan could probably speak a little bit more about the character stuff. But if you want to do character stuff, you should put that first within your portfolio. If you want to do environment stuff first, do that. It's always better to have a large number of different looks. But if you can do everything, make sure that you're spacing it out correctly and you're not just throwing everything in there hodgepodge. And I would actually recommend to anybody throwing portfolios out there to get a lot of different people looking at it. So they can tell you what they think's working for you. Because usually what I think works for me is not what works for me. It's something completely different. They're like, you didn't put this piece first. What are you doing?
Yeah.
Okay.
What are the feedback you guys
so,
have?
Well, I'd say first and foremost, quality over quantity. I think sometimes we see some portfolios that I think people are really enthusiastic to put as much stuff as they can on there. But when you have weaker elements kind of bringing down some of the stronger stuff or whatever, you're going to notice those first. So from a specific character standpoint, showing the ability of doing, you know, great anatomy on a male and a female, being able to be a little more versatile when it comes to some of the styles, like being able to see like really realistic things or something a little more stylized, good use of color, fold logic, facial expressions, like you mentioned, are really good. And just have something that, you know, looks badass, basically. You can tell from looking at portfolio if someone's just, you know, really awesome
actually,
and stuff.
You make a totally crucial point, which is that don't ever put something in there that you're kind of iffy about.
Yeah,
because
it
then it's always compared to that. You just keep looking back going, hey, their work's great except for this piece of shit over here.
What's that turd over there?
the one more thing I will say is we went to a recent
party. I was up in the city with that dude and we hung out and we had some drinks. That's fun.
That's right. Yeah. It's a good time.
I wasn't there, guys.
We mentioned the gap between film and games are, you know, they're getting so much smaller and stuff. I'm noticing that a lot of people, because they want to get into games, you'll see a lot of people trying to make these really kind of low res assets and stuff just to show like, hey, I can make an asset for a game. But the geometries we're using right now is so dense. We'd rather see just correct, you know, proper topology and just show, like, if it's super high res and it's super awesome and it's great and it's going to blow us away, that's great. You don't need to show us all these, you know, really low res kind of game assets.
Okay.
Yeah, I would agree with pretty much everything Brent and Dan. I think they covered most of it. It's all about quality over quantity. It's much better to focus, if you're an associate to mid-level environment artist and you're applying to Crystal Dynamics, it's you would have a very strong portfolio in our eyes if you could show us several props of different types, like natural versus man-made or et cetera. And really exposing the details to us, showing us your texture map, showing us your modeling, showing us your process for how you took it from ZBrush or Mudbox into Maya into like an editor package.
So process is important. Should you have just polished pieces, or is it good to show some of your workflow in there?
It's always good to show. I definitely like to see the workflow because it shows me confidence in terms of them knowing what they're doing and how they like to do it. And it lets me know, like, okay, if I bring this guy on the team, how is he going to want to work? Where can I kind of seat him with the team?
Okay. All right, so the last question is super open-ended. Any final advice for people looking to break into the game industry for a concept, character, or environment art? It can be anything, your past experiences, things to do, things to avoid.
Bribes. Bribes.
Yep.
I think disheartened everybody listening.
I think, but no, I'm just kidding. I think
we don't get paid a lot. It doesn't have to be a big bribe. <That's
right. laughs> I think Brent
and
totally,
a Starbucks gift certificate will suffice.
Yeah, that's fine. Brent mentioned it earlier. I think you really have to kind of promote yourself, get your stuff out there. We're always looking at forums and art forums and stuff, and we're always seeing some of the recent stuff that's out there. So getting your name out there and getting some strong pieces right off the bat and kind of showcasing what you can do and not kind of keeping it to yourself and, you know, showing other people and stuff. I think just promoting yourself and work. Don't get discouraged. I know it's tough kind of breaking in for the first time, but
yeah,
just be positive about it.
I think that's definitely the breaking in is definitely the hardest part. I think statistically for our industry, referrals carry a high percentage of hires into studios.
Absolutely.
So definitely, as you were saying, don't hobbit it up in a hole in the wall somewhere. Definitely try to get out there, attend like game jams, industry events like GDC, see if you can set up any sort of networking events with like colleges or universities or like other types of professional places. There's not only one way into the industry, which is, you know, certainly the way I've sort of experienced it. I've been an outsourcing manager, environment artist, a producer, a QA, lead environment artist. So there's definitely, if making games is your passion, there's definitely a lot of different opportunities out there. It's just you have to show the passion and the strength and working in those sort of positions. So
yeah. Well, that pretty much sums up everything there. You took all my answers.
One thing I've heard in past podcasts echoed is that also don't wait around. Like, you don't have to be hired by a game studio to start making games.
Yeah.
So team up with people. Find a program, work on them, be proactive. Start making your own games and your own projects and putting it out there.
Yes. I think all of us in this room, like Dan had mentioned, go home and we do our own stuff. I mean, every night we're going home and doing something. It's usually to get our mind off of Lara Croft. Constantly.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's like the advice would be don't ever fall in love with your own work.
Yeah.
I think it's important to realize that I realize almost daily now that I'm shit compared to a lot of the stuff that I see out there. No, but it's because I'll never be as good as some of those guys that I always look up to. But
you're still a really nice
keeps
guy, though.
Motivated.
And you're very really tall.
That doesn't cut it. Being nice doesn't cut it, Josh.
And that's the final piece of advice we're going to go out on. Yeah. Being nice doesn't cut it.
No.
All right. Well, thank you guys, despite all of the laughing
bits. Sorry, folks.
I think that you guys offered up some really, really great advice, both practical and humorous. So I appreciate your time, and thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So now I am joined with Scott Amos, who is an EP here at Crystal Dynamics. It's been a while since you've been on the podcast.
It has been a while. Probably since the beginning when I joined Crystal a while
ago. Yeah, we did an introductory podcast back then. So it's nice to have you back. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
So we're here going to talk about Tomb Raider Definitive Edition. So you're kind of at the helm of that and organizing everybody. Okay, so I think a good starting point is, what is Tomb Raider Definitive Edition and who developed it?
So Tomb Raider Definitive Edition started even November 2012, December 2012, right before we had finished the last-gen version, because we wanted to say next-gen consoles are coming. How do we take all the stuff that we want to do and be able to put that onto the next-generation hardware, being able to push the line, the limits, the resolution, everything we could think of. So as far back January 2013 is when we actually began Tomb Raider Definitive Edition.
Yeah.
And even then, the very beginning, the core team at Crystal said, we want to take all this stuff, everything that we'd planned to make at that point, which hadn't even shipped yet, DLC and things that we'd even thought about, all of that, and say, how do we take all of this to the next generation? How do we actually make a package and a product that feels like this great experience we're delivering on last gen, and then upgrade it and enhance it in ways that say, here's things we just wanted to do for next gen that weren't yet possible. Things like all the particle effects, new lighting, new texturing, new rendering. So we had all these ideas, all these aspirations that the original design doc we even had that we gave Sony and Microsoft said, hey, here's our vision for it, even back then, was looking at stuff we didn't know could be possible.
Yeah.
Until we actually got into the middle of, okay, here's the hardware, now what we can do with it, what we can expand on it. So we started it, we actually needed some partners because the Crystal team here, as they wrapped up the last generation, we're moving on to the next product. Mm-hmm. So we actually had a core team kept here at Crystal, but we needed some heavy lifting done elsewhere. So we brought in Nixies, people that we'd worked with for years that we've known as an external team since the Legacy of Kain days.
Yep.
And then we also added United Front Games out of Vancouver, a group that had done Sleeping Dogs. Squared introduced us to them. We met with them and discussed their philosophy and their belief in how they like to make games, and it aligned very well with us.
Mm-hmm.
So then we had these three different studio teams saying, this is a great vision of how to take this amazing game that we're finishing in 2013 and then saying, how do we bring it to next gen and all the upgrades that it would require.
Great. I think there was some confusion when we first announced that this was some sort of PC port, and that's actually not the case. This is something that's been rebuilt. So I'm going to ask a super open-ended question and just let you go. So what are the big differences or sort of talking points or things that you're excited about when it comes to Definitive Edition? And feel free to get as technical as you want, because people are going to eat that up. They love the nitty-gritty details. So
okay. So certainly when we started this, PS3, 360, and PC were kind of our foundations, right? We just finished those as a team. We had just gotten everything that we could crammed into those consoles, into that version. We said, all right, that's the starting point. So to take to a next-gen step, to take another year of development with three different studios working on it, we had to come up with something big.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a philosophy internally of saying, even if Laura stops moving, the world never does.
Yeah.
So it was this mentality, you know, we actually called it internally aesthetic dynamics.
Yeah.
The sense that the world is always alive. You've probably heard us say a few that, you know, kind of a mantra for the team here, of everything from the physics of the world, meaning particles and foliage and water and objects moving and bobbing and reacting, all of that stuff, to Laura herself saying, this is our chance to explore what next gen could be. Say, how do we take Laura as the star of the show and be able to test what next generation technology is even possible to do with her as an up-res and upgraded character?
Uh-huh.
Tress Effects was something we'd done for PC, but then we said, let's rewrite it and optimize it for next gen. Something that we hadn't seen anybody else do is bring Tress Effects hair to console. So you have that full simulated hair, thousands of strands that actually react to physics, that when she runs, jumps, falls, moves, when the wind blows through it, it reacts dynamically and correctly. So it gives a lot of life, particularly to a third person action character like this, and personality that we just couldn't get out of the performance before. And then on top of that, we said, well, now we've done her hair, we have to do her hair and makeup, right? We have to do everything else. And so that became having Brian Horton, who's our senior art director for Tomb Raider, craft and direct the experience of how do we rebuild the head, the face, how do we actually take that a step further, both in next-gen look, but also adding new technology for her face and her skin so that she has this technology called subsurface scattering. Mm-hmm. Literally, the sunlight comes in, passes through the first layer of skin, diffuses underneath that, so it gives it a much softer glow.
Mm-hmm.
Quite literally makes her look more realistic, which is amazing, great stuff for us. And again, since you're seeing her all the time, we wanted to even go further. Up-resing her model, certainly more polygons, the density of the face mesh of the entire model. Up-resing all of her textures to maximum resolution, since we know gameplay is going to run at 1080p. We wanted her to look absolutely her best. And then we added a whole new material system that dynamically interacts with the environment for her. So when she's getting wet, or when she's covered in mud or covered in blood, we wanted these things to actually reflect and change on her outfit so you could actually see this stuff and actually feel more grounded to the world as you moved her through that world. So Laura was really the first kind of set piece that we wanted to say, take that star, make her even bigger and better and bolder than we had her before, and then we have to make the world upgraded around her. And that became that aesthetic dynamics piece where we said, all this physics stuff we're adding for particles, for reacted physics, for the world as you run through it, we even put that on her. So things like her climbing axe as it's next to her, or the arrows in her quiver, even the radio on her belt, as she runs and jumps and moves, those things all react physically and are simulated to look realistic. Like they're actually bobbing and weaving and jumping around with her. And it's really an amazingly cool, while nuanced and detailed effect. It's that kind of detail that the entire team focused on from the beginning, from bushes in the world that you run through and they react as bendies, to the arrows on her back, to even bigger things like just thousands of more particles flying around, all the lighting changes we've done. We have a thing called a color lookup table, or LUT, that we have actually done in certain areas that kind of push the colors brighter and pull the blacks blacker and darker, so you actually get a much more vibrant aesthetic when you walk into certain areas, like the first shipwreck area you get to and see the ocean. It's much bluer than you've ever seen before. It's kind of a, it's kind of like a commercial where, like, one of those sinus commercials where the screen gets pulled back and the film is disappearing and now everything's brighter.
Yeah.
It actually has that feeling in some of those areas where we got to go and highlight it.
Great. Yeah, fans in particular have been really excited about the idea of Lara's gear moving. That's something that the hair, the gear moving, and then her boot buckles. Did you notice that? The boot buckles are something that the fans were very excited about when they saw how much more realistic they look.
It was absolutely a pleasure. I mean, honestly, we had dedicated character artists. The guys actually built the characters here for the last generation said, we want to do this. And this was, for us, our first attempt at next gen, and be able to say, here's how we can take Lara and just start the process, because we still have another product out there, right? We still have future versions of Tomb Raider that we'll be worrying about and talking about later, but this for us was our first kind of proving grounds and testing grounds to see what we could do.
All right, so how about the weather and lighting? Can you expand upon how that's been updated for Definitive Edition?
Yeah, certainly. One of the things that, when we talked about it from both fans and from players, we're like, you know, this island feels dangerous, and it's one of these places that we want it to feel not only alive with all these things moving, but even feel threatening constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll see, it's kind of funny, once we went back and added a whole new particle system and a new lighting system, so all the particles are now dynamically lit. As an example, when you see guys with flashlights or searchlights, when they sweep through a rainy scene, it's no longer kind of a generic effect that now each particle lights up, so you'll see the swath of light slicing through the rain as the rain is actually slicing through the air, and it's like, oh my gosh, this feels dangerous. One of the guys who recently played for a user research test said, I didn't remember how much it rained on this island,
because
he had played the last generation, and when he played this one, he had this giant smile on his face, like, oh my gosh, I didn't know it rained there, and this feels dangerous, and oh, you've added all this. And he's right. You know, the world just feels so much brighter and different with shadow casters. The idea that when you or an NPC or a character walks in front of certain lights, it casts a full shadow on the ground or on the walls. All of those nuances really add to the depth and the reality of the experience, and it makes such an amazing difference. It's really looking at last gen, as great as it was, as great a story and gameplay and everything that's there that we've kept intact, but now shown in this vision of you walking through a burning monastery building and the smoke's pulling on the ceiling, you know, or you're walking through the underground bunker area and the rain's actually coming through the ceiling and pooling on floors and the ground with reflective puddles that react as you walk through them. And that level of detail, just, it really pulls you in very quickly.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I can't wait to sit down and play it in its entirety again. It's one of those things that I think, you know, one of the things we were very much complimented on was how amazing and immersive the world look in Yamatai was on last gen. So to see it pushed even further, that's a pretty exciting prospect. All right, so what about next generation specific features with Kinect or DualShock support and so on? What do we have to offer in terms of that?
Sure. So both consoles have unique features, which is great. So on the Xbox One, since it has a Kinect with it, we definitely wanted to put voice commands in from the beginning and said, okay, now we have voice commands. Now we can actually do things like have Lara change weapons or change ammo types.
Mm-hmm.
We even use it for shortcuts inside of some of the menus where she can quickly, you know, when you want to go through and look at your skills upgrades or look at your map, those things you can actually call out and talk to your Xbox. So they're great shortcuts and kind of a nice enhancement for the player being in the game. We took those voice commands and applied them to the PS4 as well. So if you have a microphone plugged into your controller or if you have the Sony camera, both of those will let you do voice commands on PS4. So we have both voice commands on both consoles. And then we also have a lean feature, you know, basically in certain cinematic sequences where Lara is kind of climbing up the radio tower, for example. We actually added this ability for the Kinect to see you lean left to right.
Mm-hmm.
And as you do, the camera will go off axis. So what used to be a static in-game sequence that you just climb straight up a ladder, now you can actually get a different look around where she's at or what she sees on the other side of her. And again, it's a really nice immersive addition that people can see more than they could see before. So it gives a nice little touch of just, oh, I have a different way of interacting with my world.
Yeah, great.
On the DualShock controller itself, two of the things we really enjoy about it, there's a microphone, I'm sorry, so there's a speaker. There's a speaker built into the DualShock controller. And actually, when you're using and shooting your weapons, it actually reacts as though you have the weapon in your hand. So you'll hear guns cocking, you'll hear ammo changing. And we actually use it for the radio communications. So when somebody on a radio calls and talks to Lara through the radio, you'll actually hear it come out of the speaker actually on the controller. So again, it feels like you're pulled more into the world. in the front of the controller, there's actually that light bar as mm-hmm. well. For us, the light bar became an opportunity just to add one more enhancement. A lot of our players love to sit in the dark, play in a dark room, mm-hmm. but if you pull out your torch, that light bar in the front will start flickering red, yellow, and orange, so it feels like your torch is actually in your hand yeah. on the controller, just like it is in Lara's hand in the game.
Uh-huh.
And then on top of that, when Lara actually has a gun out and she's shooting, the controller will actually flash with each of the muzzle flashes. So it's just those little details. Again, all this was about bringing a richer, enhanced experience. It feels like, wow, I'm actually pulled into this game even deeper than I was the last time I played it.
So the PlayStation 4 version has Vita support also, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that we really have enjoyed with the PS4 is being able to sit with our PlayStation Vitas and stream live the game playing on the PS4.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one that just it looks amazing on the Vita, and it's one of those great things that once we put it in there, it's a remarkable experience to be able to have this really tight, condensed screen with the game streaming live. You can play anywhere as long as you're on the same network with your PS4, and it's a great addition that we got to put in there.
Awesome. So what sort of bonus content can fans expect on disc? Because it's not just the enhancements to the game. We actually kind of pooled everything together to make sure it really was the definitive edition of Tomb Raider.
And I think that's exactly right. Calling it the definitive edition means we had to include everything that we possibly had on the last game, everything that we've added, you know, for fully rebuilding this for the next-gen consoles, and then all of the content from the Tomb of the Lost Adventure, 8 DLC multiplayer maps, the 6 multiplayer weapons, 4 multiplayer characters, the 6 alternate outfits for Laura. We even included the Dark Horse digital comic. It's called Tomb Raider: The Beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then Brady Games' digital art book called Tomb Raider: The Art of Survival. And then we have 6 episodes of The Final Hours of Tomb Raiders, the documentary series that we've done, which 3 of them have been out there before, and then put all 6 of them on this one disc, so we have everything that possibly describes Tomb Raider, all the ship DLC, and all the bits that go with it.
One question we've been hearing from fans that I'd love to get you to weigh in on is why we chose not to add new gameplay or modes or so on to Tomb Raider and just really focus on enriching that original experience.
So the good news for us is that we have an award-winning game
mm-hmm.
right, that's been nominated so many times. The studio did a brilliant job of putting this game out there. The last thing we want to do is break that experience. Right,
mm-hmm.
It's so well-paced. The storyline we think is fantastic. The gameplay itself, the beats, the crescendo of action all the way up to the ending, everything that's in there feels like a great content. This is the experience we want. This is the thing that we want people to walk away from. And certainly the fans and press and everybody who's played it said, this is an amazing game. So the last thing we want to do is try and do anything to disrupt or change that. Why would we want to rewrite something that's already great?
Mm-hmm.
So don't break it if it's already working. So for us, it was more about enhancing that experience. And then adding content on top. Honestly, for us, this is a great experience, but it's a great contained experience. We have future versions of Lara and looking at the world and looking at the game that we want to do other versions of the game. This wasn't that. This was us saying it's kind of a love letter to our fans. If you really loved what Tomb Raider was, look at this as the final vision from that game, from that story, from Yamatai, from all the world that we had there as its final expression that we can put together and say this is that definitive edition. Adding more content on top of that wasn't our primary goal because we don't think it needs it. We actually think this, for people who didn't get to play on last gen or just didn't buy in yet, this is that version we want them to go and say, this is what you should check out. Hardcore fans, they're the people we make these things for. That we want them to say, this is an awesome experience. This gets to show off my next gen tech, show off my new television, whatever they have.
Yeah.
So for us, we wanted to put this experience out there and say, this is the one you want.
Yeah, and that's not to say that we didn't listen to feedback and so on. We did a huge community roundup and feedback from all of the fans and so on based on Tomb Raider, but that's something that's more applicable towards the future of the franchise.
Exactly, and I think that's the big difference for us, right? This wasn't, some 1.5 version where, here's 5 more minutes of content. We don't want to have to try and do something that feels like a justification.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we said this is a labor of love. This is a passion for us to make the best Tomb Raider experience we ever can. So we took what was a great story, made it even visually more appealing, made it actually as a world more dynamic, made it as a setting an enriched fidelity of an experience. That was what this one was.
Yep.
The feedback that we've been getting from players, everything from single player, from multiplayer, all the great ideas they've had, that is definitely in the team's hands and in the team's mind for what we're doing next.
In the future.
We will talk about that another day.
Another day. I'm sure not soon enough for fans listening to this. Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for your time. Just some quick fast facts for a definitive edition. It is coming out on January 28th in North America, January 31st in Europe. It'll be a launch title in Asia. When that's TBD. We're not entirely sure when those consoles are coming out just yet. You can pre-order yours to get an exclusive art book packaging. It's actually really cool. The discs are built into this neat little art book case featuring never-before-seen concept art. We actually went through it and we're like, have we released this yet? No, they've never seen it.
That's right.
And you can get that at tombraider.com/pre-order. I think I got it all.
I think you did. That sounds great.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Scott.
It's absolutely been my pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And that is it for this episode of the Crystal Habit Podcast. As I mentioned, we will focus again on art in the next episode. We'll tackle animation, VFX, and UI. So if you have any questions specifically about those specialties, go ahead and send them over to community@crystald.com, and I'll make sure to work them into the show. Thanks for tuning in, and have a happy holiday. Are we ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
Is this the first one? Is there a panic button? Can we?
Josh, you can move your head freely. You don't have to do this, dude. That's what's throwing me off.
I'm just going to put this clip on the end of the podcast after the outro music.
Josh guy sounds handsome. I wonder what his shirt really looks like.
It'd be great.
Is it really a V-neck?
Yeah. Well, we can take pictures of that after this as well.
This
is going
to
be a very interesting wall.
Baby blue, in case anybody's wondering.
Yeah, careful if you look into these. You better not swim and fall in.
You get lost in that ocean. The sea was angry that day.
You might want to put on a life vest the way you're looking at me.
Okay.
Good night, everybody.